From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. John Raby sitting in for John Horn, who's at home drinking hot tea with lemon and honey. Today, the latest company to start making original movies and TV isn't exactly known for creating media, more like transferring it. Then, the Australian comedian Hannah Gadsby hopes that sharing her story of growing up gay in an extremely homophobic world will bridge divides.
The human condition is what we all share, but in order to really appeal to the humanity of those you don't share experience with, you need to tell it through a story.
And we'll meet a young jazz musician from LA with a bright future coming up today on The Frame.
KPCC supporters include Freeform's The Bold Type, produced by Universal Television. Emmy-eligible in all categories, including Outstanding Drama Series. Episodes available at Freeform.com, the Freeform app, and Hulu.
And National Geographic's Jane, a documentary by Brett Morgan profiling conservationist Jane Goodall using more than 100 hours of lost archival footage. Emmy-eligible in all categories. NatGeoTV.com/FYC.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Raby in for John Horn. Thanks for joining us. Chances are, if you work with large digital files, you have used WeTransfer. The file sharing site has a streamlined design. Upload a file, enter an email, and hit transfer. I've actually used it to send an entire radio documentary to the BBC and the CBC. But it's also a cool platform for visual artists, because during the few seconds or minutes that you wait for the file to load, WeTransfer puts up eye-catching artwork and original videos, like this one from Bjork.
There's so much more to music than just work. If I collaborate, I want connections to be genuine and to be for real.
Damian Bradfield is the president and chief marketing officer of WeTransfer. He told John Horn about WeTransfer's commitment to the arts and about WePresent, a new platform that works with artists to share stories and perspectives. And he began with why WeTransfer could be successful as a content creator.
So there are 43, 44 million users worldwide, 192 countries every month. In terms of media, we're bigger than a lot of other companies that you might think of as a traditional media company. So if you look at Vice or Fader or Pitchfork or, you know, those sort of companies for the music industry, you know, we have more traffic than them. We're delivering more eyeballs. So, you know, we're able to distribute work and get access to work with different sorts of musicians and artists that others won't necessarily get access to.
When you first launched WeTransfer, did you imagine that artists would gravitate toward it? Did you market it toward that community, or did it just end up being the place where artists congregated to send files around?
I mean, the internet back in 2009, you had two choices. Basically, you were either going to make a site that was a paywall that you had to pay to get into, or you were going to have horrible banners all over the site. And we didn't want to have banners, so we wanted to make it as attractive as we could and believe that if we did that, then these photographers or creators would come, and they did.
I want to talk to you about WePresent, which is, I guess, a natural evolution of what you've been doing at WeTransfer. What is WePresent, and what was the thinking behind its launch?
So if you know WeTransfer and if you've ever used it, it's got these big images. If you click on one of those big images, you get taken to either that photographer's work or you get taken to WePresent. And WePresent basically is our, like, our storytelling platform where we try to push more long-form content. And to be honest, it's a labor of love. I mean, it's a space where we really try to tell the story that others wouldn't tell and to try and tell it in a way that a lot of other brands wouldn't necessarily take the time to tell in that format.
When you think of what role you have as curators, how do you make sure that what you're promoting and linking to is consistent with what you would define as the ethos of the company?
We now have an editorial team in Amsterdam that are, you know, actively seeking, curating, and commissioning work on a monthly basis. We have sort of three topics from the inventory that we give away. So we give away 30% of our ad inventory to support the arts. And from that, there are three sort of topics that we're mainly focused on in digital sustainability. So trying to create a better internet, climate change, and diversity. And those are sort of three main buckets that we have for content. And then on top of that, it might just be that there's someone just incredibly cool. You know, Chance, the rapper, approached us in December for a Christmas album. You know, he's an incredibly informative, cutting-edge artist. Why would you say no?
I want to ask you about a project that I've seen. It's called Mr. Wash. It's a documentary short. It's about an artist named Fulton Washington.
In 1997, I was wrongfully convicted of 3 nonviolent drug offenses. They claimed that I had purchased chemicals to be used in a manufacture of PCP, but those places I've never been in my life. The judge didn't think that a life sentence was appropriate in this case, but due to the mandatory minimums, he was forced to impose a life sentence.
His sentence was commuted by President Obama. Why did it speak to you as a good story and an artist that you wanted to promote?
It never ceases to amaze me how sometimes I feel like I've been living in a little echo chamber in Holland, unaware of some of the things that are confronting people here on a daily basis. And this is one of those things like gun reform. You just think, how can this happen? You know, in this society, how can it be that you can have so many issues? And we are gifted that we have this platform that if we can make sure the storytelling is right and makes sense to our audience and is told in a way that is appealing, we can, you know, do our bit in actually trying to educate people around some of these bigger issues that are happening.
So they don't necessarily have to be struggling artists who are trying to get an audience. They can be somebody like Chance the Rapper or Ai Weiwei or Moby or Kamasi Washington, people who have an audience but have some story that you think is a good marriage to the site.
Yeah, definitely, yeah. You know, there are an awful lot of artists out there that are restricted in some degree by their labels or by management or whatever else in the stories that they can tell. And there are certain platforms where they're just not physically able to tell a particular story. And I think, we're pretty agnostic when it comes to the stories that we want, or to be quite honest, often the weirder the better. I mean, we want to educate our user base and make sure that they're discovering stuff through us.
But the work that you're doing relies on a generation of artists and a generation of artists after that generation. And so what are you doing in terms of making sure that there are artists coming out in terms of educating those artists or supporting those artists in ways beyond what they might be able to do on the site?
So this is the beautiful bit about being in LA, right? So I don't have to do anything. Donald Trump is doing everything for me. So I think Donald Trump is creating one of the greatest creative movements that I've ever witnessed. There are, kids taking to the streets, actively producing stuff, feeling empowered to produce stuff. So I don't feel that we have to do that much. We have to just remain relevant and make sure that we, really work on the relationship side. So the team that's here in LA is out basically meeting people, and we're trying to, witness what's happening and make sure that we're talking to people and trying to be involved in the process so that we can either pick it up and help spread it or, help finance or promote some of it. But it's happening, and it's happening more so than I've ever witnessed.
Damian Bradfield is the president and chief marketing officer of WeTransfer. Damian, thanks for coming in.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Coming up, an Australian comedian who shares a lot of personal heartache between her jokes.
KBCC podcasts are supported by Freeform's The Bold Type, produced by Universal Television. Emmy eligible in all categories, including Outstanding Drama Series, and Freeform's Grown-ish, produced by ABC Signature Studios. Emmy eligible in all categories, including Outstanding Comedy Series, Outstanding Lead Actress in a Comedy Series for Yara Shahidi, and Outstanding Contemporary Costumes. Episodes available at Freeform.com, the Freeform app, and Hulu.
KPCC podcasts are supported by National Geographic's series One Strange Rock, hosted by Will Smith and executive produced by Darren Aronofsky and Newtopia. An elite ensemble of astronauts tells the unexpected and unprecedented story of Earth, filmed across 900,000 plus miles, 45 countries, 6 continents, and outer space. Emmy eligible in all categories. Visit natgeotv.com/FYC for more information. Don't just consider. Explore.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Raby, sitting in for John Horn, who is on a kind of vocal vacation. Before our next story, I want to let you know about an old and new website to check out. Today, we at KPCC relaunched LAist.com. The website is once again your comprehensive guide to life in Southern California, and now it's backed by KPCC. Check it out today at LAist.com. And now, there's a new special on Netflix today from the Australian comedian Hannah Gadsby. What stands out is that during the show, she deconstructs what she's doing.
A joke is simply two things. It needs two things to work, a setup and a punchline. And it is essentially
a question with a surprise answer, right? But in this context, what a joke is a question that I have artificially inseminated. Tension. I do that, and that's my job. I make you all feel tense, and then I make you laugh, and you're like, oh, thanks for that. I was feeling a bit tense.
In her special titled Nanette, Gadsby actually says she needs to quit comedy. Yeah, in the midst of a comedy special recorded in front of a huge crowd at the Sydney Opera House, where she's killing it, she says she needs to stop doing what she does. Hannah Gadsby, who's gay, grew up on the island of Tasmania, where she says most residents believe that gay people are subhuman. She internalized this rampant homophobia, suffered violent trauma, and then, once she began doing comedy, she made it part of her routine. But she tells John Horn that she doesn't want to do that anymore.
My whole story was always told around a joke, diffusing it, but also laughing at homophobia, not acknowledging that it existed within me. And so as throughout my comedy career, I, you know, went from telling this story and sealing off, you know, this trauma into acceptable jokes. And I, you know, began to really, really wobble in the last few years during the gay marriage debate because I was aware that there was still, you know, this deep wound of shame that has never been talked about. You know, I often say that perhaps there should be a black stripe on the gay pride flag to acknowledge publicly that trauma that so many of us live through. You don't just come out and instantly undo shame. You need the entire community that helped place that inside of you to also help undo that.
Somebody who I think knew the trauma that was to come and the toxicity of homophobia and how it affects people as your mom. There's a passage in the show where you talk about your mom, and I want to play a little bit from that scene.
But what my mom eventually said to me is pretty much at the core of why I'm questioning comedy. She said to me, "The thing I regret that I raised you as if you were straight. I didn't know any different. I am so sorry. I'm so sorry. I knew well before you did that your life was going to be so hard. I knew that, and I wanted more than anything in the world not to be the case. But I now know I made it worse. I made it worse because I wanted you to change, because I knew the world wouldn't." And I looked at my mum in that moment and I thought, how did that happen? How did my mum get to be the hero of my story? Sorry, that struck me. I haven't sort of watched my own special, listened to myself, so that's kind of, that's thrown me a little bit. And my mum was in the audience that night.
Oh, my goodness.
It made it such a difficult filming. What was incredible about that apology that Mum gave me is that it wasn't one that I asked for. It wasn't one that I knew I needed. You know, I thought, well, fine, we've dealt with it. And I think it's an incredible story that as a family we moved through from being basically ignorant and homophobic, all of us, to, you know, being completely not. And that was enough for me. And then she came through with that apology, which said to me, she still interrogated that story. And I just don't think we hear apologies like that in our world, where there's no reservation, no defensiveness, no excuses, taking full responsibility. And also, you know, to offer that apology without being asked. And for my mind, yes, that does make my mum the hero of this story. And it did force me to really question the way that I've told my story, which was to turn trauma into a joke. Part of my problem is comedy has suspended me in a perpetual state of adolescence. The way I've been telling that story is through jokes. And stories, unlike jokes, need three parts, a beginning, a middle, and an end. Jokes, only two parts, a beginning and a middle.
We're talking with Hannah Gadsby about her stand-up special called Nanette. How did you start thinking about what you were performing and this kind of greater concept of What is the contract between the audience and the performer? Because there is a very deep and meaningful and incredibly intellectual conversation that you have with yourself in front of the audience about this whole idea. How did that become something that you were thinking about and that you wanted to share?
There's a lot of complex ideas sort of met at a head at the point of writing the show. And I was in a, you know, very angry space because I was frustrated, not just because of the gay marriage debate, but then Donald Trump was elected. And unfortunately, he's not just your president. I was just struck by the very destructive way that our leaders tend to speak, and that we're electing businessmen as if humanity is some kind of business and profit is how you measure the worth of a human. And I was making a documentary at that time as well about the nude in art. I studied art history, and I kept talking to these so-called good guys, you know, the left-wing leaning men who work in the arts, who were just, you know, casually dismissing the brutality of a lot of their so-called geniuses. And so all these things, you know, and I was a bit frustrated where my career was. I felt like I'd plateaued, that I felt like, you know, I saw the rise of very, you know, perfectly fine young men, my peers, just getting all the opportunities. And I'm like, I don't mean to sound arrogant in my own head, but I think I'm better than these fellas. And what I worked out is that it was my story that wasn't important. So therefore, my skill set didn't matter because it was working around a story that was in the margins. So it didn't matter how good I was at comedy, how good a joke I could work, or how well I could control a room. Because my story doesn't matter, I wasn't going to go much further. So really, that show was written around like throwing the gauntlet down. I make the claim I'm going to quit, and the reason I did that was to subvert, you know, every time a woman does something like that on stage, we're told we're not comedians, we do monologues or one-woman shows. And no man has ever, you know, no man has shown his vulnerability on stage and, you know, no comedian, and been reduced to, oh, he's just doing a bit of theatre now. As like, so with this show, I'm just like, no, I'm going to write the best comedy show, deconstruct the joke, and throw it back in your face and go and live in a cave.
One of the things that your studying art history gave you is not only a very good way to defuse a critic who brings up Van Gogh and his mental health or lack thereof, but also this bigger idea about perspective, that the way that an artist sees the world and the way that other people see the world. And it got me thinking about, you know, something that you really touch on in your show is that it's impossible for a male attorney to know what it feels like to be a female lawyer in a room filled with men. It's impossible for a white motorist to know what it's like to be driving while black and stopped by the police. And as we're dealing with everything that's going on in the world, how do people like me, I'm a straight white male, how do we change our perspective so that we understand others better?
It's just through story. Facts, we've seen this. One of the big things that I think I observed with the fake news phenomenon is that, you know, the facts don't actually matter. What fake news was and still is something that's sort of appealing to a already told story. And that story is the victim of, you know, Middle America being a victim. And then the conspiracy theories of why, you know, this struggle there being pinned onto minorities. And so that's when I started to really invest in the idea of story, because stories can be told constructively in a way that appeals to humanity of an individual and going, hey, I'm a human, and to touch on the human condition from a different perspective. You know, so it's like the human condition is what we all share, but in order to really appeal to the humanity of those you don't share experience with, you need to tell it through a story, because it really is the only way that you stop people fearing your difference, is to make yourself look just as human as they are. And our leaders are not invested in that as an idea. So I believe it's up to cultural leaders and anyone with a public voice to really demand space for minorities to take up space in the world and to, you know, have their own voice and tell their own story.
Hannah Gadsby's, what do we call it, a special? Hannah Gadsby's show, Nanette, premieres on Netflix on June 19th.
I'd like to just add, yes, for all those clips that you played there, it is a really funny show, too. It's got a pretty good joke rate.
It does have a very good joke rate. I will give it that, definitely that. Hannah Gadsby's show, Nanette, premieres on Netflix on June 19th. Hannah, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh, well, thank you.
Coming up, we'll meet a young musician from L.A. who's a rarity, a female jazz bassist.
KPCC supporters include HBO, presenting Westworld. Live without limits in a world where every human appetite can be indulged. This dark odyssey follows the dawn of artificial consciousness and the evolution of sin. In this hit series, a group of android hosts deviate from their programmers' carefully planned scripts in a disturbing pattern of aberrant behavior. Chaos takes control in the second season of Westworld, Emmy eligible for Outstanding Drama Series and all other categories.
22 of the country's best young jazz musicians are heading to New York for the first NYO Jazz Program, an offshoot of the National Youth Orchestra. Not only are they going to study together, but they will perform at Carnegie Hall and then go on tour playing some of the greatest music venues in Europe. Anna Abondolo, a recent graduate of Crossroads School for Arts and Sciences in Santa Monica, is one of those lucky, talented young musicians. Carla Javier, KPCC's arts education reporter, brings us her story.
At a recent rehearsal in the Crossroads Jazz Room, the A-band takes a crack at Anna Abondolo's newest composition.
Okay, so let's check out Anna's tune.
It's her third as a bassist.
When I wrote this tune, I was kind of thinking I wanted a sweet kind of vibe, but also kind of nostalgic, emotional, and like raw. It was like a reflection of, you know, what has happened in my life, but also looking into the future a little bit.
Which is kind of where she is in life right now. Anna just finished her senior year at Crossroads, and she's looking forward to studying music at the college level in the fall. It's a fitting trajectory for a talented young musician, the daughter of two professional musicians, who's been playing since she was four. Her mom, Josefina Vergara, is the second principal violinist in the Los Angeles Chamber Orchestra and a session musician for TV and movies.
We sort of said, well, you know, in this house, just like other people brush their teeth, you play piano, because it's sort of the foundation to learning how to read music.
So Anna started early, first piano, next she played violin, and then cello. When she got to eighth grade and it was time to choose an instrument to study in school, there was a bit of a problem.
They didn't have an orchestra option.
So she picked up a bass. It wasn't easy. After all, the cello and the bass are tuned differently, and jazz involves a lot more improv than classical. But to everyone's surprise, she liked it.
She's like, I'm not going to, Mom, I can't do classical. I can't do orchestra now. I have to do jazz.
I like cello, but something about jazz, like, I love. I think I felt a little bit more emotionally connected to, you know, improvising, playing the bass.
That was 5 years ago. Since then, Anna's become quite the accomplished bassist. Her resume of performances and awards spans pages and features big names like the Stanford and Berkeley Jazz Combos and the Monterey Jazz Festival. She even was named one of the Music Center's Spotlight Award Grand Prize finalists last year. For context, other Grand Prize finalists over the years include Misty Copeland and Adam Lambert. And in the fall, Anna's headed off to the New England Conservatory of Music in Boston for college. But before that, she's making a pit stop.
We're going to perform in Carnegie Hall.
Yeah, that Carnegie Hall.
Carnegie Hall is like one of the biggest venues to perform at as a musician. Like, it's just a huge venue. It's pretty historical. It's like a dream come true.
Anna was one of 22 young jazz musicians from around the country who were selected for the Carnegie Hall Weill Music Institute's first ever NYO Jazz program, which means not only will she and other young musicians get to perform at the famous music hall, they'll also get to study music together for a few weeks and go on tour, playing venues across Europe. Anna got in by submitting some tapes of her improvising and playing standards and video essays.
The prompt I chose was just like a musician who inspires you. And so I started talking about like one of my favorite musicians and someone I've looked up to. Her name's Esperanza Spalding. She's a bass player. Someone I've been listening to since I started playing the bass.
Anna says she admires Spalding for her musicianship and control of a band. But they have something else in common, too. They're both female musicians in what's often considered a male-dominated jazz world. It's hard to find industry-wide stats on this, but at Berklee College of Music, of the 105 jazz composition majors, less than 25% are women. And when I visited Crossroads' top jazz band, Anna was the only female musician in the room. Even at NYO Jazz, just 4 of the 22 students chosen are young women this year.
I've usually been the only girl in many ensembles. Jazz is a very like male-dominated field.
Though Anna thinks that's starting to change. Even at her college, the chair of jazz studies says there are more than twice as many female students in the department as compared to 2 decades ago.
Especially, I think, in terms of like jazz education, there's a lot more emphasis on like trying to get girls into jazz at an early age.
Her high school jazz teacher, Evan Avery, says it's her talent and her drive that made her a strong candidate for the Carnegie Hall program.
She's fierce in her determination to get the music right. And also, she consistently supports others in what they're trying to do artistically.
Anna has ambitious goals for her time at NYO Jazz, like getting more comfortable improvising at jam sessions. That, she says, can be really intimidating, given her classical music background.
Sometimes you don't know the tunes, so you're kind of learning it on the fly. So I think just a lot of these jam session experiences really help me. And I think it's going to prepare me for college and like what's to come.
Her mom says that's something she's noticed since Anna made the switch to jazz.
I admire so much the ability to improvise. I can't imagine. I think that's the top.
Anna says she's looking forward to the program, and not just because she'll be spending it studying what she loves. Music.
Not only are you like pursuing music at a really high level, but you're also living alone for 5 weeks. So I think that's going to be just nice to kind of gain more independence.
You're going to be doing jazz. You're going to be on the road a lot. So I think it's going to be good and a good experience for her to see what that entails and what it's like to move around from one city to another and how you have to take care of yourself sometimes.
Anna and her mom think the experience will prepare her for college and for what she wants to do afterwards.
I really want to have my own band, be a band leader, play my own compositions, also hopefully play with like some of my heroes who are now like living in New York.
But before all that, Anna Bondolo and the young musicians of NYO Jazz will play Carnegie Hall on July 27th. For The Frame, I'm Carla Javier.
And that's The Frame for today. I'm John Raby. Thanks for listening. With luck, John Horn will be back tomorrow. We'll see you then.